was a red button.
What you're watching, Daddy and I watched that same program with Morgan Freeman on the stars and stuff, remember? It's been a while, but we've watched it. It's been on several times.
This is something new, Mom.
Mom, this is something new. Totally new. I don't think that's
what she's talking about.
This just started a couple weeks ago. It's on Sunday nights.
So our, the Lord's Prayer begins, "Our Father, which art in heaven." Could it have begun as our mother? This is a symbolic image. All the references of religious and mythological images are to planes of consciousness or fields of experience that are potential in the human spirit. And these images evoke attitudes and experiences that are appropriate to a meditation on the mystery of the source of your own being. There have been systems of religion where the mother is the prime parent, the source. The mother is really more of an intermediate parent than the father, because one is born from the mother, and the first experience of any infant is the mother. I've frequently thought that mythology is a sublimation of the mother image. We talk of Mother Earth, and in Egypt you have the Mother Heavens, the goddess Nut, who represented as a whole the heavenly sphere. I was seized in Egypt upon first seeing the figure of Nut in the ceiling of one of those temples. Campbell says, "Yeah, I know the temple. It's overwhelming in both its ability to evoke awe and in its sensual character. The idea of the goddess is related to the fact that you're born from your mother, and your father may be unknown to you, or the father may have died. Frequently in the epics, when the hero is born, his father has died, or his father is in some other place, and then the hero has to go in quest of his father. In the story of the incarnation of Jesus, the father of Jesus was the father in heaven, at least in terms of the symbology. When Jesus goes to the cross, he is on the way to the Father, leaving the mother behind. And the cross, which is symbolic of the earth, is the mother symbol. So on the cross, Jesus leaves his body on the mother, from whom he has acquired his body, and he goes to the Father, who is the ultimate transcendent mystery source." So Moyer says, "Well, what impact has this father quest had on us down through the centuries?" Well, it's a major theme in myth. There's a little motif that occurs in many narratives related to a hero's life where the boy says, "Mother, who is my father?" And she will say, "Well, your father is in such and such a place." And then he goes on the father quest. In the Odyssey, Odysseus' son is a tiny babe when Odysseus goes off to the Trojan War. The war lasts for 10 years, and then on his journey home, Odysseus is lost for 10 more years in the mysterious world of the mythological Mediterranean. Athena comes to this, Odysseus' son, who is now 12 years old, and says, "Go, find your father." He doesn't know where his father is, so he goes to Nestor and asks, "Where do you think my father would be?" And Nestor says, go ask Proteus. And then he's off on the father quest. Moyer says, "Well, in Star Wars, Luke Skywalker says to his companions, 'I wish I had known my father.' There's something powerful in the image of the father quest. But why no mother quest?" Well, the mother's right there. You're born from your mother. And she's the one who nourishes you and instructs you and brings you up to age when you must find your father. Now, the finding of the father has to do with the finding of your own character and destiny. There's a notion that the character is inherited from the father, and the body and very often the mind from the mother. But it's your character that is the mystery, and it's your character that is your destiny. So it's the discovery of your destiny that is symbolized by the father quest. So when do you find your father and find yourself? Campbell says, "Well, We have a word in English at one minute with Father. You remember the story of Jesus lost in Jerusalem when he's a little boy about 12 years old. His parents hunt for him. And when they find him in the temple in conversation with the doctors of the law, they ask, "Why did you abandon us this way? Why did you give us this fear and anxiety?" And he says, "Didn't you know I had to be about my Father's business?" He's 12 years old, and that's the age of adolescent initiations, finding who you are. Morgan says, "Well, but what happened along the way to this reference that in primitive societies was directed toward the goddess figure, the great goddess, the Mother Earth? What happened to it?" Well, that was associated primarily with agriculture and agricultural societies. It has to do with earth. The human woman gives birth just as the earth gives birth to plants. She gives nourishment just as plants do. So woman magic and earth magic are the same thing. They are related. And the personification of the energy that gives birth to forms and nourishes forms is properly female. It is in the agricultural world of ancient Mesopotamia, the Egyptian Nile, and in earlier planting culture systems that the goddess is the dominant mythic form. We have found hundreds of early European Neolithic figurines of the goddess, but hardly anything there of the male figure at all. The bull and certain other animals, such as the boar and the goat, may appear as symbolic of the male power, but the goddess was the only visualized divinity at the time. And when you have the goddess as a creator, it's her own body that is the universe. It is identical with the universe. That's the sense of, that's the sense that the goddess nut figure that you saw in the Egyptian temple, that she is the whole of the sphere of the life enclosing heavens. Moyer says, "Well, there's one scene of the goddess swallowing the sun, remember?" Campbell says the idea is that she swallows the sun in the west and gives birth to it in the east, and it passes through her body at night. So it would be natural for people trying to explain wonders of the universe to look to the female figure as the explanation of what they see in their own lives. Campbell says, "Well, not only that, but when you move to a philosophical point of view, as in the goddess religions of India, where the goddess symbology is dominant to this day, the female represents Maya. The female represents what in Kantian terminology we call the forms of sensibility. She is time and space itself. And the mystery beyond her is beyond all pairs of opposites. So it isn't really male and it isn't female. It neither is nor is not. But everything is within her, so that the gods are her children. Everything you can think of, everything you can see, is a production of the goddess. I once saw a marvelous scientific movie about protoplasm. It was a revelation to me. It is in movement all the time, flowing. Sometimes it seems to be flowing this way and that, and then it shapes things, has the potentiality for bringing things into shape. I saw this movie in Northern California, and as I drove down the coast to Big Sur all the way, all I could see was protoplasm in the form of grass being eaten by the protoplasm in the form of cows, and the protoplasm in the form of birds, diving for the protoplasm in the forms of fish. You just got this wonderful sense of the abyss from which all things come. But each form has its own intentions, its own possibilities, and that's where the meaning comes, not in the protoplasm itself." Wasn't it inevitable that this idea would die under the weight of scientific discoveries? We know now that plants don't grow out of the bodies of dead people. They grow according to the laws of seed and soil and sun. Didn't Newton kill myth? Campbell says, oh, I think myth is coming back. There's a young scientist today who's using the term morphogenic field, the field that produces forms. That's who the goddess is, the field that produces forms. What's the significance for us? Well, it means to find what is the source of your own life and what is the relationship of your body, your physical form, to this energy that animates it. The body without the energy isn't alive, is it? So you distinguish your own life, that which is of the body, and that which is of energy and consciousness. In India, the most common ultimate symbol is the phallus, or lingam, as they call it, of the generating god, penetrating the vagina, or the yoni, as they call it, of the goddess. In contemplating this symbol, you are contemplating the generating moment itself of all life. The entire mystery of the generation of life is symbolically contemplated in that sign. You see, the sexual mystery in India, in most of the world, is a holy mystery. It is the mystery of the generation of life. The act of generating a child is a cosmic act and is to be understood as holy. And so the symbol, that which most immediately represents this mystery of the pouring of the energy of life into the field of time, is the lingam and the yoni, the male and the female, powers in creative conjunction. Moyer says, well, what would it have meant to us if somewhere along the way we'd begun to pray our mother instead of our father? What psychological difference would it have made? Well, it certainly has made a psychological difference in the character of our culture. For instance, the basic birth of Western civilization occurred in the great river valleys, the Nile, the Tigris and Euphrates, the Indus, and later the Ganges. That was the world of the goddess. The name of the Ganges is the name of the goddess, for example, Gaia. And then there came the invasions. Now, these started seriously in the 4th millennia BC and became more and more devastating. They came in from the north and from the south and wiped out cities overnight. Now, as a footnote, 4th millennia BC, that's when Rome started noticing all these barbarians coming in from the north. It's also the same time that the 4 million lost tribes of Israel were released and supposedly went across the Caucasus Mountains, which is exactly where they came from. Can't be a coincidence.
The Danites, right?
Well, just it was all of them.
Oh, the whole, all the tribes, right.
So, just read the story in the book of Genesis of the part played by Jacob's tribe in the fall of the city of Shechem. Overnight, the city is wiped out by these herding people who have suddenly appeared. The Semite invaders were herders of goats and sheep, the Indo-Europeans of cattle. Both were formerly hunters, and so the cultures are essentially animal-oriented, not agriculturally oriented. When you have hunters, you have killers. And when you have herders, you have killers, because they're always in movement, nomadic, coming into conflict with other people, and conquering areas into which they move. And these invasions bring in warrior gods, thunderbolt hurlers, like Zeus or Yahweh. The sword and death instead of phallus and fertility. That's right, and they are equated. There's a story that you tell about the overthrow of the mother goddess Tiamat. And this is Sumerian. It goes back to Sumerian mythology. I guess that could be taken as the key archetypal event here. You call it a critical moment in history. Yes. The Semitic people were invading the world of the mother goddess system, so the male-oriented mythologies became dominant. And the mother goddess becomes, well, sort of a grandmother goddess way, way back. It was in the time of the rise of the city of Babylon, and each of these early cities had their own protective god or goddesses. And the characteristic of an imperialistic people is to try to have their own local god dubbed the big boy of the whole universe, you see. No other divinity counts. And the way to bring this about is by annihilating the god or goddess who was there before.
Well, that goes back to Genesis when it talks about Abraham. And studying him, they worshipped a moon goddess called Nana.
Yes. Also and, Sumerian. Yes. Yes.
And that's when God spoke to him to loose that moon goddess and move on.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much, and this is pretty much true everywhere, but Egypt's a good example. Every different city is kind of highlights one god. Well, the one that was here before the Babylonian god Marduk was the all-mother goddess Tiamat. And so the story begins with a great council of male gods up in the sky, each god a star, and they have heard that Grandma is coming, old Tiamat, the abyss, the inexhaustible source. She arrives in the form of a great fish or dragon. And what god will have courage to go against Grandma and do her in? And the one who has the courage is, of course, the god of our present great city. He's the big one. So when Tiamat opens her mouth, the young god Marduk of Babylon sends winds into her throat and belly to blow her to pieces. And he then dismembers her and fashions the earth and the heavens out of the parts of her body. This motif of dismembering a primordial being and turning its body into the universe appears in many mythologies in many forms. Now, the mother goddess in old mother goddess mythologies was herself already the universe. So the great creative deed of Marduk was a super erogatory act. There was no need for him to cut her up and make the universe out of her, because she already was the universe. But the male-oriented myth takes over, and he becomes, apparently, the creator. And the interest turned from the goddess to her son, this young political upstart who, Campbell says, well, the interest turned to the interest specifically of the male governors of the city of Babylon, which goes to what you're talking about. So the matriarchal society gave way to a patriarchal society. Campbell says, well, yeah, by that time, 1750 BC or so, that it was finished. Yes, but all those motifs and themes were controlled by males, priests, bishops, who excluded women. So whatever the form might have meant to the believer, for the purpose of power, the image was in the hands of the dominant male figure, which is what he was talking about. You can put an accent on it that way, but I think it's a little too strong, because there were some great female saints. Hildegard of Bingen, she was a match for Innocent III, and Eleanor of Aquitaine, I don't think there's anybody in the Middle Ages who has the stature to match hers. One now can look back and quarrel with the whole situation, but the situation of women was not that bad by any means. Moyer says no, but none of those saints could ever become pope. Campbell said, no, but becoming pope, that's not much of a job, really. That's a business position.
Yeah, really.
None of the popes could have ever become the mother of Christ. There are different roles to play. It was the male's job to protect the women. Moyer says that's where the paternalistic idea grew. Campbell says, women are booty. They are goods. With the fall of a city, every woman in the city would be raped. Moyer says, well, There's this ethical contradiction mentioned in your book, quoting Exodus. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, except abroad. Then you should put all males to the sword, and the women you shall take as booty to yourself. That's right out of the Old Testament. Campbell says Deuteronomy, and those are fierce passages. Moyer says, and what do they say about women? What do they say to you about women? Campbell says, well, they say more about Deuteronomy than they do about women. The Hebrews were absolutely ruthless with respect to their neighbors. But this passage is an extreme statement of something that is inherent in most sociologically oriented mythologies. That is to say, love and compassion are reserved for the in-group, and aggression and abuse are projected outward onto others. Compassion is to be reserved for members of your own group. The out-group is to be treated in a way described there in Deuteronomy. Now, today there is no out-group anymore on the planet. And the problem of a modern religion is to have such compassion work for the whole of humanity. But then what happens to the aggression? This is the problem that the world is going to have to face, because aggression is a natural instinct just as much as, and more immediate than, compassion. And it is always going to be there. It is a biological fact. Of course, in biblical times, when the Hebrews came in, they really wiped out the goddess. The term for the Canaanite goddess that's used in the Old Testament is the abomination. Apparently, throughout the period represented in the Book of Kings, for example, there was a back and a forth between the two cults. Many of the Hebrew kings are condoned in the Old Testament for having worshipped on the mountaintops. Those mountains were symbols of the goddess, and there was a very strong accent against the goddess in the Hebrew, which you do not find in the Indo-European mythologies. Here you have Zeus marrying the goddess, and then the two play together. So it's an extreme case that we have in the Bible, and our own Western subjugation of the female is a function of biblical thinking. Moyer says, well, because when you substitute the male for the female, you get a different psychology, a different cultural basis. And it's permissible in your culture to do what your gods do, so you just... Campbell says, yeah, that's exactly it. I would see three situations here. First, the early one of the goddess, when the male is hardly even a significant deity, which is during the agricultural phase. Then the reverse, when the male takes over a role, which is the hunter and herder's phase. And then finally, the classical stage, where the two are in interaction, as they are also, for example, in India. Moyer says, well, where does that arise? Campbell says, it comes from the attitude of the Indo-Europeans, who did not completely devalue the female principle. Moyer says, well, what about the virgin birth? Suddenly the goddess reappears in the form of the chaste and pure vessel chosen for God's action. Campbell says, well, in the history of Western religions, this is an extremely interesting development. In the Old Testament, you have a God who creates a world without a goddess. And when you come to Proverbs, there she is. Sophia, the goddess of wisdom, who says, when he created the world, I was there, and I was his greatest joy. But in the Hebrew tradition, the idea of a son of God is repulsive. It is not considered at all. The Messiah as the Son of God is not actually God's son. He is one who is in character and dignity, is worthy to be likened to the Son of God. I'm sure there's no idea of a virgin birth in that tradition. The virgin birth comes into Christianity by way of Greek tradition. When you read the four Gospels, for example, the only one in which the virgin birth appears is the Gospel according to Luke. And Luke was a Greek. And in the Greek tradition, there were images, legends, myths of virgin births. Campbell says, oh yes. Leda and the Spawn, Persephone and the Serpent, this one, that one, and the other one. The virgin birth is represented throughout it. Warrior says, well, this was not a new idea then in Bethlehem, but what's the meaning of the virgin birth? Campbell says, I think the best way to answer that is to talk about a system they have in India that describes stages of spiritual development. In India, there's a system of 7 psychological centers up the spine. They represent psychological planes of concern and consciousness and action. The first is at the rectum, representing elimination, the basic life-sustaining function. The serpent represents this compulsion as a kind of traveling esophagus going along and just eating and eating and eating. None of us would be here if we weren't forever eating. What you eat is always something that just a moment before was alive. This is the sacramental mystery of food and eating, which doesn't often come to our minds when we sit down to eat. If we say grace before our meals, we thank this figure out of the Bible for our food. But in earlier mythologies, when people would sit down to eat, they would thank the animal that they were going to consume for having given itself a willing sacrifice. There's a wonderful saying in one of the Upanishads, I can't hardly say that word anyway. Oh wonderful, oh wonderful, oh wonderful, I am food, I am food, I am food. I am an eater of food, I am an eater of food, I am an eater of food. We don't think that way today about ourselves, but holding on to yourself and not letting yourself become food is the primary life-denying negative act. You're stopping the flow. And a yielding to the flow is the great mystery experience that goes with thanking an animal that is about to be eaten for having given of itself. You too will be given in time. I'm nature. Nature is me. Yes. Now, the second psychological center is symbolized in the Indian order of spiritual development by the sex organs, which is to say the urge to procreation. A third center is at the level of the navel, and here is the center of the will to power, to mastery, and achievement, or, in its negative aspect, to the conquering, mastering, smashing, and thrashing of others. This is the third or aggressive function. And as we are given to recognize in the symbolism of the Indian psychological system, the first function is of an animal instinct, the second, procreation, is of an animal instinct, and the third, mastery and conquest, is also an animal instinct. And these three centers are located in the pelvic basin. The next, or fourth center, is at the level of your heart, and this is the opening to compassion. Here you move out of the field of the animal action and into a field that is properly human and spiritual. And for each of these four centers, there is envisioned a symbolic form. At the base, for example, the first one, the symbol, is the lingam and the yoni, the male and female organs in conjunction. At the heart center, there is again a lingam and a yoni, that is to say, male and female organs in conjunction. But here they are represented in gold as symbolic of the virgin birth. That is to say that it is the birth of spiritual man out of the animal man. And it happens when you awaken at the level of the heart to compassion, calm, passion, shared suffering, experience participation in the suffering of another person. That's the beginning of humanity. And the meditations of religion properly on that level, the heart level. Moyer says, well, you say that there's the beginning of humanity, but in these stories, that's the moment when gods are born, the virgin birth. It's a god who emerges. Campbell says, and do you know who that god is? It's you. All those symbols in mythology refer to you. You can get stuck out there and think it's all out there. So you're thinking about Jesus with all the sentiments relevant to how he suffered out there. But that suffering is what ought to be going on in you.
You.
Yes.
You have been, have you been spiritually reborn? Have you died to your animal nature and come to life as a human incarnation of compassion? Warrior says, well, why is this significant that this is of a virgin? Campbell says, the begetter is of the spirit. That is the spiritual birth. The virgin birth is of the word through the ear. Warrior says, the word like a shaft of light. Campbell says, yes. And the Buddha, with the same meaning, is said to have been born from his mother's side at the level of the heart chakra.
Interesting. I've seen that picture before somewhere.
Heart chakra meaning? Oh, well, the heart chakra is the symbolic center associated with the heart. Chakra means circle or sphere. So the Buddha comes out. Campbell says the Buddha is born from his mother's side. That's a symbolic birth. He wasn't physically born from his mother's side, but symbolically. Moyer says, but the Christ came the way you and I did. Campbell says, yes, but of a virgin. And then according to Roman Catholic doctrine, her virginity was restored.
Yeah, so, I always had trouble with that.
So nothing happened physically, you might say. What is symbolically referred to is not Jesus' physical birth, but his spiritual significance. That's what the virgin birth represents. Heroes and demigods are born that way as beings motivated by compassion and not mastery, sexuality, or self-preservation. This is the sense of the second birth, when you begin to live out of the heart center. The lower three centers are not to be refuted, but transcended, when they become subject to and servant to the heart. Warrior says, well, if we go back into antiquity, do we find images of the Madonna as the mother of the child savior? Yes. The antique model for the Madonna actually is Isis with Horus at her breast.
Yeah. I've seen that before.
Yeah, it's in the Vatican.
Yeah.
They've got a big statue right when you walk in for all the tourists. And it actually was taken from a pyramid in Haiti. Campbell says, well, it's a complicated story. Indeed, all of these get to be pretty complicated. But Isis and her husband Osiris were twins, and they were born of the goddess Nut, and their younger relatives were Seth and Nephthys, who were twins born from the same goddess. One night, Osiris slept with Nephthys, thinking that she was Isis, a kind of inattention to detail, as you might say.
Yeah.
From
really, at some details.
Well, listen to this, because it sounds a lot like some of the stories.
I know. The mind draws that picture.
From that night's event, Anubis was born, who is the god of the underworld. Osiris' oldest son, but by the wrong wife. Seth, her husband, took this badly and planned to kill his older brother, Osiris. So secretly he took Osiris' measurements and had a beautiful sarcophagus made that would exactly fit him. And then one evening, when there was a lively party in progress among the gods, Seth came in with his sarcophagus and declared that anyone whom it perfectly fitted could have it as a gift for his tomb. Everyone at the party tried, and of course, when Osiris got in, it fitted him perfectly. Immediately, 72 accomplices came rushing out. They clamped the lid on, strapped it together, and threw it into the Nile. Now, I don't know why he didn't include this, but probably for space. Actually, his body was chopped into 13 different parts. That's where you get the 13 tribes.
Yeah, gotcha.
Anyway, so what you have here is the death of a god, and whenever you have the death of such a god as this, you may next expect a resurrection. The god of Osiris was symbolically associated with the annual rising and flooding of the River Nile, by which the soil of Egypt was annually fertilized, and was as though the rotting of the body of Osiris fertilized and vitalized land. This is the same motif that you run into with Christ being crucified at that specific time of year, because that's the end of the winter period, the beginning of planting. Agricultural thing that goes back beyond human memory.
Well, aren't there also 13 lunar months?
Yes, it's 13 months. It always has been.
Yeah.
So Osiris, he goes floating down the Nile. He's washed ashore on a beach in Syria. A beautiful tree with a wonderful aroma grew up and incorporated the sarcophagus in its trunk. The local king had just had a son born to him and happened at the time to be about to build a palace. And because the aroma of the tree was so wonderful, he had it cut down and brought in to become the central pillar in the main room of the palace. Meanwhile, the poor god Isis, whose husband has been thrown into the Nile, started off on a search for his body. This theme for the search of the god who is the spouse of the soul is a prime mythological theme of the period, of the goddess who goes in quest for her lost spouse or lover, and through loyalty and descent into the realm of death, becomes his redeemer. Isis comes to the palace and there learns of the aromatic column in the royal palace. She suspects that this may have something to do with Osiris, and she gets a job as a nurse to the newborn child. Well, she lets the child nurse from her finger. After all, she's a goddess. And there's a limit to the degree of stooping to conquer. But she loves the little boy and decides to give him immortality by placing him in the fireplace to burn his mortal body away. As a goddess, she can prevent the fire from killing him, you understand. And every evening, while the child was in the fire, she transforms herself into a swallow and goes flying mournfully around the column in which her husband is enclosed. One evening, the child's mother comes into the room while this little scene is in progress, sees her infant in the fireplace, lets out a scream, which of course breaks the spell, and the child has to be rescued from incineration. The swallow, meanwhile, has turned back into a gorgeous nurse and goddess who explains the situation and says to the queen, "By the way, it's my husband there in that column. I'd be grateful if you would just let me take him home." So the king, who has appeared on the scene, says, "Why, yes, certainly." He has the column removed, turns it over to Isis, and the beautiful sarcophagus containing Osiris is placed on a royal barge. On the way back to the Nile Delta, she removes the coffin lid. Now, he also left this part out. In the process of doing this, Osiris's penis was lost because it was one of the parts that was cut off, and it was eaten by a crab. So in Egyptian mythology, they hate crabs. Hey, that's why they use a dung beetle instead of a crab for their astrology.
Yeah, they did. Testify to that.
Anyway, so what she ends up doing is having to fashion something out of clay to serve as his member. She lies with his body. Wait a minute, I just lost my place. Oh, yeah. So she lies with the dead husband and conceives. This is a motif that appears in the ancient mythologies all the time, under many symbolic forms. Out of death comes life.
Yeah, and thus Adam made out of clay.
Yes.
Perfect. Perfect.
So when the barge has landed, the goddess gives birth in the papyrus swamp to her child, Orus. And it was the figure of this divine mother with her child conceived of God that became the model for the Madonna. Mm-hmm. And the swallow became, did it not, the dove? Well, the dove, yes. The bird in flight is pretty nearly a universal symbol of spirit, as in Christianity, of the Holy Ghost. With the mother is conceiving of the spirit, one has... But one more little detail here. The jealous younger brother, Seth, meanwhile, has usurped the throne of Osiris. However, to properly represent the throne, he should marry Isis, because she's the firstborn female. In Egyptian iconography, Isis represents the throne itself. The pharaoh sits upon the throne, which is Isis, as a child does in its mother's lap. And so, when you stand before the cathedral of Chartres, it's French, you will see over one of the portals of the western front an image of the Madonna as the throne upon which the child Jesus sits and blesses the world as its emperor. That is precisely the image that has come down to us from most ancient Egypt. The early fathers and early artisans took over these images intentionally. Moyer says, well, the Christian fathers took the image of Isis? Definitely. They say so themselves. Read the text where it is declared that these forms, which were merely mythological forms in the past, are now actual and incarnate in our Savior. The mythologies are referred to were of the dead and resurrected God, Attis, Adonis, Gilgamesh, Osiris, Dionysus, etc.
It's 13 of those, isn't it?
7, I think. That I know of. The death and resurrection of the God is everywhere, associated with the moon, which dies and is resurrected every month. It is for 2 nights or 3 days dark, and we have the Christ for 2 nights or 3 days in his tomb. No one knows what the actual date of the birth of Jesus might have been, but it has been put on what used to be the date of the winter solstice, December 25th, when the nights begin to be shorter and the days longer. That is the moment of the rebirth of light. That was exactly the date of the birth of the Persian god of light, Mithra.
But not Jesus. Wasn't it proven?
No.
He was born in September.
No, there wouldn't have been. I've been to Israel in the winter, and there would be no shepherds out. It's pretty cold. It says to me that there's an idea of death to the past and birth to the future in our lives and our thinking. Death to the animal nature and birth to the spiritual. These symbols are talking about this one way or another. Moria says, so Isis is able to say that, you know, I am she that is the natural mother of all things, mistress and governess of all the elements, chief of the powers, divine, queen of all that are in hell, but principal of all them that dwell in heaven, manifested alone and under one form of all the gods and goddesses. Campbell says that that is a very late statement in the whole theme that comes in The Golden Ass. 2nd century AD. The Golden Ass is one of the first novels, by the way. Its leading character, its hero, has been, by lust and magic, converted into an ass. And he has to undergo an ordeal of painful and humiliating adventures until his redemption comes through the grace of the goddess Isis. She appears with a rose in her hand, symbolic of divine love, not lust, and when he eats this rose, he is converted back into a man. But now he is more than a man. He is an illuminated man, a saint. He has experienced the second virgin birth, you see.
Beautiful.
So, the mere animal-like carnality may pass through a spiritual death and become reborn. The second birth is of an exalted, spiritually informed incarnation. And the goddess is the one who brings that about. The second birth is through the a spiritual mother. Notre Dame de Paris and our mother church, we are reborn spiritually by entering and leaving a church. Notre Dame means portal of the Virgin. Moyer says, well, there is a power that's unique to the female principle. Campbell says, in this novel it has been put that way, but it's not necessarily unique to her. You can have the rebirth through the male also, but using this system of symbols, the woman becomes the regenerator. So, Moyer says, when the Council of Ephesus met in the year 431, after the death of Christ, and proclaimed Mary to be the Mother of God, it wasn't the first time? Campbell said no. In fact, that argument has been going on in the church for some time. But the place where the decision was made at Ephesus happened at the time to be the greatest temple city in the Roman Empire of the goddess Artemis, or
so
Diana.
This was after the Council of Nicaea.
No, this is prior to the Council of Nicaea.
Okay.
I think. Yeah, I think the Council of Nicaea happened later. It was 431. 431. It was like, I don't know. It was later, though.
I don't know either. That's why.
So anyway, the city where this occurred, it was the greatest temple city in the Roman Empire of the goddess Artemis or Diana. And there is a story that when the council was in session arguing this point, the people of Ephesus formed picket lines and shouted in praise of Mary. The goddess? The goddess? Of course she's the goddess. Well, what you have then in the Catholic tradition is a coming together of the patriarchal, monotheistic Hebrew idea of the Messiah as one who is to unite the spiritual and temporal powers, and the Hellenistic classic idea of the Savior as the dead and resurrected Son of the great goddess by a virgin birth. There were plenty of such saviors reborn. In the Near East, the god who descended into the field of time was originally a goddess. Jesus took over what is really the goddess's role in coming down in compassion.
Absolutely. He was the perfect type of divine feminine.
But when the virgin acquiesces in being the vessel of the incarnation, she has herself already effected the redemption. It's the same story as Tiamat and Marduk.
Yes, it is.
It has become more and more apparent that the Virgin is equivalent in her suffering to the suffering of her Son. In the Catholic Church now, I think, she is called the co-savior. Moyer says, well, what does all of this say about the reunion of the male and the female? For a long while in primitive societies, the male's dominant. I'm sorry, the female is dominant, and then comes along this masculine, aggressive, warlike image, and soon we're back to the female playing a role in creation and recreation. Does it say something about the basic yearning of men and women for each other? Campbell says yes, but I think of it more in historical terms. It's a very interesting thing to see that this mother goddess was the queen right across to the Indus Valley from India, from the Aegean to the Indus, she is the dominant figure. Then you have the Indo-Europeans coming down from the north into Persia, India, Greece, Italy, and there you have a male-oriented mythology coming in, all along the line. In India, it's the Vedas. In Greece, it's the Homeric tradition. And then about 500 years later, the goddess begins coming back. There is actually, there's one from about the 7th century, which is just about the time she's coming back to full force in the Aegean as well, where the Vedic gods are coming together, and they see a strange sort of amorphous thing down the way, a kind of smoky fog, and ask, what's that? None of them knows what it could be. So one of them suggests, I'll go find out what it is. As he goes over to do this smoky thing and says, I am Agni, the Lord of Fire. I can burn anything. Who are you? Out of the fog there comes flying a piece of straw, which falls on the ground, and the voice says, Let's see you burn that. Agni finds that he can't ignite it, so he goes back to the other gods and says, this is surely strange. Well then, says the Lord of Wind, let me try. So over he goes, and the same sword thing takes place. I am Vayu, Lord of the Wind. I can blow anything around. Again, a straw is thrown. Let's see you blow that. And he can. So he too returns. Then Indra, the greatest of the Vedic gods, approaches. But he, as he draws near, the apparition vanishes. And where it has been, a woman appears, a beautiful, mysterious woman who instructs the gods, revealing to them the mystery of the ground of their own being. That is the ultimate mystery of all being, she tells them, from which you boys yourselves have received your powers. And it can turn your powers on or off as it wills. The Indian name for that being of all beings is Brahman, which is a neuter noun, neither male nor female. And the Indian name for the woman is Maya Shakti Devi, goddess, giver of life, and mother of forms.
Deepak teaches
that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, he would. That's his background.
Vedic gods that you're speaking of.
And there, in that, she appears as teacher of the Vedic gods themselves. Moyer says, well, it's the female wisdom. Campbell says, it's the female as the giver of forms. She is the one who gave life to the forms, and she knows where they came from. It is from that which is beyond male and female. It is from that which is beyond being and non-being. It both is and is not, is neither and is not, is beyond all categories of thought and the mind. Moyer says, well, there is that wonderful saying in the New Testament. In Jesus, there is no male or female. In the ultimate sense of things, there is neither. Campbell says, it would have to be. If Jesus represents the source of our being, we are all, as it were, thoughts in the mind of Jesus. He is the Word that has become flesh in us too.
That's beautiful.
Moyer says, you and I possess characteristics that are both male and female. Campbell says the body does. I don't know anything about the actual dating of all this, but sometime in the fetal period, it becomes apparent that this child is going to be male, and this one is going to be female. Meanwhile, it's a body with the potentialities for either inflection.
Yes.
Moyer says, so through life we are honoring or suppressing one or the other. Yes, and in that yin-yang figure from China, in the dark fish, or whatever you want to call it, there's a light spot. And the light spot, or in the light one, there's a dark spot. That's how you can relate. You couldn't relate at all to something in which you did not somehow participate. That's why the idea of God as the absolute other is a ridiculous idea. There could be no relationship to the absolute other. Moyer says, in this spiritual transformation that we're talking about, won't the changes depend on those feminine characteristics such as nurturing, creativity, and collaboration instead of competition? Isn't this at the heart of the female principle we're discussing? Campbell says, well, the mother loves all her children, the stupid ones, the bright ones, the naughty ones, the good ones. It doesn't matter what their particular character is. So the feminine represents, in a way, the inclusive love for progeny. The father is more disciplinarian. He's associated much more with the social order and the social character. This is actually the way that it works in societies. The mother gives birth to his nature, and the father gives birth to his social character, you might say. I'm almost done. So when we say save the earth, we're talking about saving ourselves. Campbell says yes. All this hope for something happening in society has to wait for something in the human psyche, a whole new way of experiencing a society. And the crucial question here is, as I see it, simply, With what society, what social group do you identify yourself? Is it going to be with all the people of the planet, or is it going to be with your own particular in-group? This is the question. Essentially, it was in the minds of the founders of our nation when the people of the 13 states began thinking of themselves as one nation. Yet, without losing consideration for the special interests of each of the several states, why can't something like that take place in the world right now? Moyer says, well, a question arises in discussing all this, the male-female principle, the virgin birth, the spiritual power that gives us the second birth. The wise people of all times have said that we can live the good life if we learn to live spiritually. But how does one learn to live spiritually if one is of flesh? Paul said the desires of the flesh are against the spirit, and the desires of the spirit are against the flesh. So how do we learn to live spiritually? In ancient times, there was the business of the teacher. He was to give you the clues to the spiritual life. This is what the priest was for. Also, this is what ritual was for. A ritual can be defined as an enactment of a myth. By participating in a ritual, you are actually experiencing a mythological life. It's out of that participation that one can learn to live spiritually. Moyer says, well, the stories of mythology actually point the way to a spiritual life? Campbell says, yes, but you got to have a clue. You got to have a roadmap of some kind, and those are all around us, but they're not all the same. Some speak only of the interest of this in-group or of that, this tribal god or of that. Others, especially those that are given as revelations of the great goddess, mother of the universe and of us all, teach compassion for all living beings. There also you come to appreciate the real sanctity of the earth itself, because it is the body of the goddess. When Yahweh creates, he creates man of the earth and breathes life into a deformed body. He's not present there, or he's not himself there present in that form. But the goddess is within as well as without. Your body is of her body. There is in these mythologies a recognition of that kind of universal identity. Moyer says, well, that's why I'm not so sure the future of the race and the salvation of the journey is in space. I think it might be right here on Earth, in body, in the womb of our being. Campbell says, well, it certainly is. When you go out into space, what you're carrying is your body, and if that hasn't been transformed, space won't transform you. But thinking about space may help you realize something. There is a two-page spread in a world atlas which shows our galaxy within many galaxies, and within our galaxy, the solar system. And here you get a sense of the magnitude of this space that we're now finding out about. What those pages opened to me was the vision of a universe of unimaginable magnitude and inconceivable violence. Billions upon billions of roaring thermonuclear furnaces scattering from each other. Each thermonuclear furnace a star, and our sun among them. Many of them actually blowing themselves to pieces and littering the outermost reaches of space with gas, dust, out of which new stars with circling planets are being born right now. And then from still more remote distances beyond all these come murmurs, microwaves that are echoes of the greatest cataclysmic explosion of all, namely the Big Bang of creation, which according to some reckonings may have occurred some 18 billion years ago. And that, there's where we are, kiddo. And to realize that, you realize how really important you are, you know. One little micro bit in that great magnitude. And then must come the experience that you and that are in some sense one, and that you partake of all of it. So what he's saying is that all is one.
Yes. Yeah, I can hear what he's saying. This so goes along with the Sophia Pistos, and especially the fallen Sophia. Mm-hmm. She bursts 13 negatives into being. Mm-hmm. What spirits, attitudes, and she has to be redeemed. So that goes along with Christ coming to the earth as Jesus. And
it's also in the
he became the feminine of God to show us what divine feminine was.
It's also in some of the most ancient Hellenistic portrayals, like in their myths. What is her name? Pandora.
Yes.
Pandora's box.
There's a lot to it.
You know, she gave birth. Long story short, her and her husband.
Minions.
Her and her husband had sex. They created mankind. Yeah. But in creating mankind, they created all the negatives.
Yes.
The only thing left in the box was hope. He's
done. To me, see, that goes back to the Elohims in the first creation.
Yeah.
Where it says all of the Elohims had a say. So.
Right.
That's kind of chaotic world we live in until we become. Go through a rebirth.
Well, it's a re-understanding of why the ancients had everything split up, and it was almost always 12 gods or 13.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to see that. Yeah. Well, where did everybody?